The Tom Woods Show, episode 1244.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, don't forget my friend Bob Murphy has an amazing new book where he takes all his critiques of Paul Krugman from over the years, all these devastating smashes, and organizes them in one volume according to topic. And these are topics you want to master, and Bob will help make you the master of the universe. Check it out at ContraKrugmanBook.com, and I am the narrator of the audiobook version, and you can get that for free when you check out the Audible offer at TomWoodsAudio.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. I am very, very glad that Michael Rechtenwald is joining us once again. You may remember him as the professor at NYU who got into trouble for his anonymous Twitter account that he eventually revealed voluntarily. He eventually revealed his identity. But Michael Rechtenwald had been on the left, I mean the serious, hard left, for many, many years. He was more or less a Marxist. He moved in circles where he was very familiar with postmodernism, so he's not going to caricature it. He lived it. He opposed it as a Marxist, but he lived it. And he knew all about critical theory. He knew all the people involved. He had an extremely eventful and interesting academic career, but within the past couple of years, he just became so disoriented by the degeneration of the left and just the absurdity of some of the social justice warrior behavior that he had to start commenting on it, and that got him in unbelievable trouble. We're going to talk about that in a minute. We talked about that with him last time. I don't want to spend most of the time on that, because I want to talk about some of his history, because he had a very interesting career. But then also what I think you're going to like about this conversation is the end. I mean, first of all, I think it's a great conversation all the way through. But when we get to the end, it's a tremendous ending. You know, there are some episodes of this show that don't have particularly uplifting endings. This one does. The kind of thing that we're going to observe at the end of this episode is extremely rare. You just never, almost never see somebody have the kind of experience that's going to be described at the end of this episode. So we want to talk in particular about Michael's new memoir, Springtime for Snowflakes, Social Justice and Its Postmodern Parentage. Michael is a clinical professor of liberal studies at NYU. His areas of interest are many. Among them are the history and philosophy of science, secularism, science and literature, and many others. He's the author of 19th Century British Secularism, Science, Religion, and Literature, and he holds his PhD in Literary and Cultural Studies from Carnegie Mellon University. And here we go with our conversation. Oh, I've got so much I want to ask you about here. Now, the way you've organized this memoir is, I think, very sensible. You start off with the controversy you're known for.
Right.
That draws the reader in. And then you go back in time and you trace out really the course of your life and how you came to be who you are, ideologically and professionally, career choices. All these things are worked out. I mean, it was interesting to read actually about your educational background as a young man and the fact that you didn't want to be an athlete, and this made your family kind of crazy. In a way, by the way, although nobody ever gave me a hard time for not being an athlete and for just wanting to be an academic, I do recall many, many Christmas parties in grad school where I would go home and we'd go over to my dad's side of the family, which was huge. And they just, I mean, God bless them, they just weren't really familiar with graduate school. So what I would get would be, and here I was at a highly prestigious graduate school, and they would say to me, so, what are you doing, Tom? You still in school or what? You know, like they couldn't, like, it was like contemptuous. Like, in other words, right. Like I'm out here working with my hands. What the heck are you doing all day? But Right. Anyway, they don't talk that way to me anymore. But in those days, I used to get that. But anyway, so all these travails of your life, but also there's a rich discussion in here of different ideologies that we're contending with today. And then wrapping up with kind of coming full circle.
Right.
So given that you've been on here before, and I'll link to that episode. Let's try and just summarize quickly what happened to you at NYU, so then we can get into this meaty stuff about how you became Michael Rechtenwald. So let's start with, why did you start the initially anonymous Twitter account? you're an NYU professor. What's your status right now with NYU? You actually got a promotion, oddly enough.
Yeah, I'm a full professor, and so it's the highest rank. I don't have tenure because there is no tenure in my program. But yeah, got a promotion in the midst of all this.
Right.
And it was really unrelated. But why I started the Twitter account is because I was just becoming so alarmed and annoyed by what was going on in terms of social justice taking over the university. And one of the big things that really irked me was in the fall of 2016, NYU established a bias reporting hotline, which I thought was really pernicious. And also there was a lot of speakers being shut down, Milo Yiannopoulos being one of them, and a number of other things, like a lot of talk about safe spaces and trigger warnings, and a lot of defenses of those practices, especially trigger warnings, and then a lot of identity politics in the hiring and promotion and other processes that were really, really alarming and annoying, and also quite damaging, I think, to the university's credibility and its teaching mission. So I started tweeting that from an anonymous account. It was it's called Anti-PC NYU Prof. That is still the handle. And I called myself the deplorable NYU prof. And, there's two parts of a Twitter account. You have the actual literal handle and then the name. My name was deplorable NYU prof. The account was replete with a Nietzsche icon. And I just started tweeting things about, what I saw happening on campuses, NYU and elsewhere. Before you know it, I was contacted by an NYU student newspaper reporter who wanted to make sure I was really an NYU professor. And if so, would I do an interview? And I agreed, but I wasn't sure I was going to go on the record as myself. After the interview was over, I decided to go on the record as myself because I thought what I said has to be said. And then all hell broke loose. I was put on a paid leave of absence almost immediately. A committee calling themselves the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Group attacked me roundly. And, that attack by that group, an official committee of NYU, really set the table for everything that would follow.
All right. Let me go back a bit here, though, because when you were called into whatever dean's office it was,
right,
the dean leans forward and says, "Now, look, this doesn't have anything to do with your Twitter account or that interview."
Right.
And you thought to yourself, "Yeah, I'm sure it's just a coincidence that you called me in."
Right.
And then the impression was given that really we're just concerned about your mental health.
Right.
And you probably need to go take a break. So they're as if they couldn't be, as if they thought, well, gee, is there one more Stalinist box we haven't yet checked off here at NYU? It's accuse him of mental illness.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. When I got into the dean's office, he shakes my hands and comes very close to me, about 6 inches from me, and says, "I just want you to know this interview, this discussion has nothing to do with your Twitter account and publicity you're getting." And I said, "Oh." I was surprised, but I didn't believe it, quite frankly. And then he goes, "And if you don't mind, with your permission, I'd like to have the head of human resources join us." And she was waiting just outside the door. I had no idea. I hadn't seen her. And then I said, "Of course, what am I going to say? No." And then that discussion ensued in which they said that people were concerned about me and that some saw my interview and Twitter account as a cry for help.
Yeah. So, but I mean, in a way, it is a cry for help against these very people.
Exactly. It's a cry for help against the very forces that I'm now facing. And they sort of made it like it was an ultimatum, an unclear ultimatum, nevertheless. And I've been called, I've been called a liar for this. And this really irks me beyond belief.
Oh, yeah, because let me summarize it for you. Because what they're saying is, "Oh, look, that Rechtenwald, what a drama queen. We never forced him to go on
right.
leave. We just had two extremely highly placed people at the university whom he would be a fool to oppose, who have much more power than he has. And normally every leftist in the world considers power relations in negotiations like this, except they won't consider it in this case.
Right.
And we told him we thought it was a good idea for him to go on leave. It was purely voluntary. Again, how Stalinist can these people be? Does every word have to mean its opposite that comes out of their mouths?
Exactly. It was really, really very, very Kafka-esque or Stalin-esque. And, you know, I mean, they said that I lied about this because a medical leave of absence is legally and by necessity voluntary. But as you said, the power differential was so great and I was coerced into it. And then, of course, all these leftists agreed with, you know, believed NYU over me, which is very ironic in my mind. Because here are people that would oppose massive institutions, and especially what they would call like the corporate university, which is, you know, NYU is the prototype for. And they would always oppose them. But no, not in this case, since I was making comments that they didn't like, you know. It's very interesting. And the left is full of opportunism today, I think. But that's another story we can get into.
Yeah. Oh, there's so much here. All right. Let's actually go back now and talk a little bit about your evolution. But really what I want to do is get into some of the ideas that you came to accept. I mean, you studied under Allen Ginsberg. You knew some pretty influential people back in the day.
Yes.
And you, in fact, I believe you say in the book that you attribute to Ginsberg, or at least he's one of the people you think whose ideas ultimately contributed to postmodernism.
Oh, yeah.
What I want you to do, actually, if we can abstract from your experience for a minute, I'd like you to explain, because you even say in here that Jordan Peterson doesn't quite get postmodernism right. You say that he sometimes calls it neo-Marxism, and it is anything but that.
Right.
So I'd like, if can you explain for normal people these three things, postmodernism, post-structuralism, and critical theory?
Okay, sure. Let's start with critical theory, since chronologically it's the first of the three. Critical theory was founded by three neo-Marxists, okay, or basically by the Frankfurt School of Critical Theory, as they're called. Theodor Adorno, Max Horkheimer, and Herbert Marcuse are the three major players there. And it is a school of criticism that started to see culture as extremely influential and powerful because, in their minds, the working class had effectively failed the mission of Marxism. And as such, they started to look for other explanations for why that was the case. Because according to Marxist rationality, this should not happen. It should not happen that the working classes actually are sort of attached to the system. And that, in fact, especially in the United States, they seem to be very happy. This is, you know, in the 50s and so forth, right? So they looked to culture and they started seeing culture as this dominating force that, you know, that was inculcating this propaganda into workers and brainwashing them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They also initiated a critique of the Enlightenment, of Enlightenment rationality, which in my mind is the beginning of the postmodern turn towards this kind of critical and skeptical and anti-rationalist eventuality that is really the beginning of postmodern theory. But they weren't postmodernists per se. They are neo-Marxists, and they're neo-Marxists because they're no longer looking to the working class as the agent that will overthrow everything. They start looking for different constituencies, and they start to look at identity politics as a possibility in the case of Marcuse. And he's really foundational for the new left, which starts to cobble together different constituencies as the hope for overthrowing capitalism, because no longer do they see the working class as the agent that's capable or really interested in doing so. And that was really a blow to the whole Marxist enterprise. The problem is that most workers didn't want it, you know. You know, they saw what happened, and this is American workers, they saw what was going on in the Soviet Union, they wanted no part of this. And that's just, they just couldn't figure this out. So they ascribed it to the power of culture to brainwash them. And a very influential essay called The Culture Industry, Enlightenment as Mass Deception, is a very key pivotal text regarding this. That's their critical theorists, and they inaugurated two schools of thought, critical theory and media studies. So media studies from the very beginning is Marxist. Okay. Then you said postmodernism. Postmodernism is a very large umbrella term, and under which it contains several theories of postmodern theory. Postmodern theory is not a consistent, uniform set of beliefs or a systematic approach. Rather, it is a whole slew of sometimes self-contradictory ideas. Post-structuralism is one of them. But postmodern theory is characterized generally by a rejection of what they call master narratives, and that is those types of systematic approaches that explain or pretend to explain all of history, like Marxism, for example. So it starts off as a rejection of Marxism. Secondly, it has a focus on language. And this is where deconstruction comes in, and I can talk further about that. And third, it is highly relativistic. It's about relativism in general. It's against positions that say this is true, this is objective. So it's anti-objectivity and pro-relativity. That's postmodernism in a nutshell. Post-structuralism is a school of thought, or an approach, to be more precise, an approach that is fits well beneath the postmodern rubric. It is a postmodernist theory. And post-structuralism is, wow, it is almost unbelievably difficult movement or approach to explain. Just generally, it's against structuralism, which structuralism tried to explain everything in terms of cultural, in terms of universals that went across cultures. Post-structuralism claims there are no universals at all. Everything is arbitrary. Everything is peculiar. History has no trends. Everything is merely a peculiar occurrence that's specific to itself. So they speak of things like historicity, which means a historical moment having its own peculiar specificity. It is focused on language. It thinks that language, for example, is utterly arbitrary and has no relationship to what it signifies. This is a very big point, because it accounts for the skepticism it has about attaining knowledge, in particular scientific knowledge. Science is very much critiqued because it's all based on language, and language has no necessary connection to what it refers to. So that's those three in a nutshell.
All right. Well, that was a yeoman's effort there, because that was a difficult assignment I gave you. Now, let me run by you something somebody in my, I have a private Facebook group, something somebody said about this, because in there, generally, there's hostility when you use the term postmodernism. But
yeah,
I've got a handful of people who say, now, hold on a minute. It's true that there are some nutballs who employ it, but if we take it to mean simply looking critically at so-called meta-narratives, that this can be a healthy attitude. That he says, for example, you know, we in this group, in my group, we're all libertarians. And well, don't you look askance at the meta-narrative by which the state must be the central organizing principle of society? And there are many, many corollaries of that, all of which you also disagree with. So you look at the world through an entirely different meta-narrative. And so in a way, you are imbibing the spirit of postmodernism. So there's no reason to throw out the baby with the bathwater. How would you answer that?
Well, this is belying the fact that this is a very slippery slope, because what happens is postmodernism leads to an utter fragmentation such that there are no truth claims that can be made whatsoever, because everybody has their own peculiar positionality and their own truth. And therefore, no truth trumps any other truth, and therefore there is no truth. And that the other thing is, it's a self-refuting statement that there are no credible master narratives because there are meta-narratives, because postmodernism is a meta-narrative. It's a meta-narrative that says there are no meta-narratives, you know, so it's self-refuting. But the bigger problem is not that logical self-refutation. The bigger problem is the endless fragmentation of standpoints such that we can't make claims about anything in the end. There's no truth claims that can be made which aren't relativized by virtue of being standing next to somebody else's truth claim. And this leads to complete, utter fragmentation and eventually what I call epistemological solipsism.
You're somebody who wrote widely in journals where people shared these sorts of worldviews. So you're not coming at this really from the point of view of an outsider, although today you right. more or less think of yourself as an outsider, but you were very much part of this.
Right.
And as I read your book, it's I'd like you to maybe spell out a little more clearly for me exactly. It couldn't have been just at one particular moment that you said, wait a minute. I mean, because obviously your case, what happened to you at NYU and the way people treated you, that would actually make me stop and think, well, gee, everybody who shares my worldview is acting like a Stalinist apparatchik.
Yeah.
Maybe there's something screwy about the worldview. I'm not even sure I would go that far. I don't know what I would do in that situation. It would be so bewildering to me. But it couldn't have just been everything snowballing. It couldn't have just been that one moment. So I want to know, during your career, were there little moments where you said, well, this is kind of screwy or that's kind of oddball?
Oh, yeah, all along. First of all, let me just make one last comment about postmodernism and Marxism. This is very little known, but there's a huge contingent of Marxists that despise postmodern theory and they totally eschew it and they totally condemn it. I was one of those. So it's not as if I was breaking with everything at once. I had already broken with things like postmodern theory.
What is Marxism if not a meta-narrative?
Right, exactly. And postmodern theory was born as a philosophical explanation for the failure of Marxism in the 1968 student rebellion in France. This is what's very little known, that in fact, postmodern theory was born as a result. It's the answer, philosophical rebuttal, if you will, to the Marxist explanation for society and social change and historical change.
Michael, let me take a minute to say a word for one of the sponsors I have been the most proud to feature just because of the sheer value they deliver to people who listen to this show, and that's Skillshare. It's like Netflix for learning job skills that will get you ahead in your profession or give you a side hustle or even be the foundation for your own small business. One membership gets you access to everything they have, over 23,000 classes. And I'll just draw from a few that are on the Skillshare homepage at random. Ink drawing techniques, learn how to mix music, how to build and brand your own success as a freelancer, how to master Illustrator, how to get started with email marketing, fundamentals of DSLR photography, and with one membership, you get access to all of it. Well, here's a great chance to join the millions of students already on Skillshare today with a special offer just for my listeners. Get 2 months of Skillshare for just 99 cents. That's right, Skillshare is offering Tom Woodshow listeners 2 months of unlimited access to over 23,000 classes for just 99 cents. To sign up, go to Skillshare.com/woods. Again, go to Skillshare.com/woods to start your 2 months now. That's Skillshare.com/woods. Well, you've got some discussion in here, by the way, of the whole gender and transgender controversy. I'm going to actually leave that out. That you have to go out and buy the book to read. You got to buy Springtime for Snowflakes and read about that, even though I'm sure that's a topic that interviewers would want to talk to you about. But instead, I want to ask you this, you know, kind of a deep question here, which is that, again, you had what turned out to be a horrific experience, not just with the way they dealt with your Twitter account right. you know, by forcing you out, but then also the subsequent treatment and the shunning and the blocking you on Facebook. I mean, you know, like you're back in high school. It's that silly.
Right.
It's possible. I mean, you could. I think there were probably people in the communist world who, even when their comrades turned on them, were still true believers.
Yes, that's right.
So I wonder, in your case, you say, look, I was on the left. I've never thought of myself as a libertarian, much less a conservative. But right. yet, by the end of this book, I have a tantalizing sense that maybe you're one of these rare people who's made a late in life ideological transformation. And I just feel like I want to say to you that if I had been a serious scholarly leftist, and then I started looking around seriously at alternative intellectual homes, and I encountered the conservative movement of Rick Santorum and Bill Kristol, I think I'd pluck my eyes out. So I hope this has not been remotely a temptation for you, but I'm curious to know about where you would place yourself today.
Well, I do place myself as a cultural, social, and somewhat economic libertarian. I think it's the only thing that preserves individual rights, and there are no other kind of rights. I don't believe in group rights because groups always override individual rights, and therefore nobody has any rights, really. The only thing that protects individual rights is libertarianism as a social, cultural, and even economic movement. Nothing else comes close. Nothing else can ensure it. And I think that the United States, where we are today, is on the verge of throwing away the best experiment that we've ever had in history for ensuring such rights.
Now, listen to what you're saying, Michael Rechtenwald. Listen to yourself saying those words. Those are words that would have come out of your mouth over your dead body 30
That's
years
right.
ago, right?
That's right.
So tell me, who are you reading these days?
Well, I mean, I've read von Mises. I've been reading Hayek. I've been reading just really broadly into the economic criticism of Marxism, because I did reject it, first of all, along ideological lines in terms of the political totalitarianism that is inevitable. And then I started to go also then into the critique of the economic system. And I found that also to be completely faulty and also antithetical to what it claims to do. And I talk about that in the book.
There is an economist, if you were to promote him, you'd get in even more trouble than you are now, but named Hans Hermann Hoppe. And he has a very interesting article on Marxism where he says, I actually think that the primary claims of Marxism are correct. It's just that they've misidentified who the villains are. So I do believe there's systematic exploitation in society, mm-hmm. but I believe it's carried out by the state. He says, and I do believe there are classes in society, but they're defined by the state. Mm-hmm. It's the state versus everybody else. Mm-hmm. And then he goes through and he says that actually, when you put it through this filter, it's not so bad after all. You know, so
right.
I may be inclined to actually email that over to you. But that's shocking to me that, I mean, I can't imagine getting to the end of my life and saying, oh, doggone it. All right, let me open up Das Kapital and start going through it. I just can't imagine after I'd fought my whole life in the other direction.
Right.
I know. That must be really, really difficult.
It was very disorienting at first. I got to say, it was like I had come out of Plato's cave and now was looking around with a glaring sun in my eyes.
Yeah.
So it was very tough, but I got through it. I just had to muscle my way through. And also, quite frankly, to have faith that I was heading in the right direction. And I did believe that, and I still do.
That's tremendous. But on the other hand, you must encounter a lot of people who are anti-leftist who just really have no idea what it is they're opposing. They couldn't tell you what a postmodernist is if their life depended on it. Does that frustrate you at all?
Well, yes. It's become too easy to dismiss things that they don't really or have never really investigated, frankly. And I hear this all the time, and it frustrates me because some of these people that are dissing postmodern theory don't even know what it is. So I would think that you should really have to know what it is before you can reject something like that. But I want to say that also, I would also, as a Marxist, though, I was always fiercely independent. So I was always trying to carve out a more libertarian leftist position. And I did run into trouble with that almost all the way. But it reached more or less a crescendo, and that's when the tipping point happened.
Did you ever read an article that Eugene Genovese wrote back in 1994? It was in a periodical called Dissent. I don't know if they still publish it or not.
I think they publish, yeah.
And it was called The Question. And the question was, what did you know and when did you know it about the crimes of communism? Because now, of course, there are plenty of Marxists who, even at the time, said, I in no way endorse what's going on in the Soviet Union.
Right.
This has nothing to do with what I support. But as you well know, there were people. I mean, the Foner family clearly did cheer on the Soviet Union. You know, try as they may to pretend they didn't. They certainly did.
Yeah.
And so some of them did have to pretend things weren't happening or whatever. So I don't know if you ever because there was a big controversy developed over that. They all jumped on Genovese because he was saying, look, I've been a Marxist for many years, and I feel like all I have to show for myself is piles of corpses. So that is making me kind of go back and say, yeah, I guess that maybe none of it was real Marxism, but geez, man, the consistency of every time that M word comes up, it seems like there's something screwy here.
Every time. Every time the experience. Well, this interesting thing, as I'd like to point out here, is that these kind of texts only became visible to me after I made the turn. They were somehow occluded or obscured from my vision. And there are many such texts that many Marxists do not know about because they're somehow shielded from them by virtue of the tunnel they're put in intellectually, such that they don't look left or right around these things. There's blinders on and ideological blinders and blinkers that make it almost impossible to see these alternative viewpoints and to see these texts. Because one is pointed, one's whole reading diet is dominated by a certain predilection and a certain end, a telos. And therefore, one doesn't find these things. I never had heard of the Black Book of Communism, for example, until after I left the movement. And then I read it and I was like, oh my God.
Yeah.
94 million people. And that's a credible number of people killed. You know, and it didn't start with Stalin. It started with Lenin, and it started within a year or less after the revolution of already sending people to the concentration camp, shooting them in the back of the head, things like that, or the front. The main thing is that terror was endemic to the whole process from the beginning, always, every time. And I had no idea that Even Leninism was always misrepresented in many Marxist texts, many. And academic Marxism, in fact, sanitizes the whole thing. You know, somebody like Frederick Jameson, you never even get a clue of what happened under Stalin or Mao if you read Jameson.
I'd like to know about the status of your academic life these days. I'd like to know about your colleagues, and I'd like to know about your current scholarly and writing interests.
Yes, that's great. Thank you. I have 4 years remaining on a 5-year contract. The committee that will decide upon my renewal will be drawn from the faculty that shuns me. Almost 100% of them shun me. I have about 100 colleagues, and there's probably 2 that say hello to me. The rest utterly shun me. People won't even get on an elevator with me. They act as if I have some sort of leprosy that might be contagious, or that I am so vile morally that I can't even be admitted to the same passageways as them. Therefore, my office was moved to the Russian department. Okay.
Oh, it's, man.
The ironies are so poetic. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's as if I was like a Russian bot who fixed the election or something. I'm in the Russian department in an office that's completely isolated. I have no contact, no one there. Even in the Russian department, they must have been told, do not speak to this guy.
Oh, that is unbelievable. Could you imagine if one of their people were treated like this with even one-tenth of the intensity? We would never hear the end of the white privilege and the oppression. We'd never hear the end of it. Never.
Right. I am completely quarantined. They put me in this office with these metal bookshelves and must have instructed everybody in that department. This guy is, you know, anathema. He is actually, do not speak to him. Do not talk to him. Do not say hello, because I am completely non-personed over there. And I kind of like in a way, because I don't have to do a lot of nonsense committee work, which is all kind of busy work. Most of the time, nothing comes out of these committees except more committees, meetings on meetings, you know the drill. And, you know, I like the independence because I don't have to answer to anybody. I mean, it's as if I don't even work for the university. I just teach classes. Nobody says anything to me about anything. I'm not told to go to meetings. Nobody's telling me anything. I'm basically completely a free agent.
Oh, that's great. You don't have to do committee work and stuff? No. That's great.
Not at all.
Because who would want you on a committee?
They can't. That's the problem. I can't do any committee work because no one will allow me on any of the committees.
I mean, I know I shouldn't laugh at this. I mean, it must, on some level, must actually be quite difficult to endure this. It's just the sheer malevolence of these people, especially when they're the ones who preen about showing off their superior morality 24 hours a day.
Yeah, somebody recently on Facebook, on Amazon, in the comments about my book, somebody hit it right on the head. There was two ways this could have been avoided. One, I never speak out against these issues, and I go along with the herd, and nobody knows what I really think. Or two, they could have just accepted that the other people have different views, and they didn't need to condemn me officially and then drive me to the margins of society in their mind.
Yeah.
But no, they had to do it this way. I blame that committee for all of this, that diversity, equity, and inclusion group, which is, in my mind, is the, of course, conformity, inequity, and exclusion group.
I had somebody on a couple of years ago, April Kelly Wessner. She's at Elizabethtown College, and she's done work on arguing that the millennials, she says, are the most intolerant generation of all, and that this seems to be paradoxical because aren't they the ones who are so open-minded to all different types of groups? But she says, toleration really is not about how do you feel and act toward people you already like and agree with.
Right.
The real test of toleration is how do you treat people you disagree with?
Right.
And yeah, you can find some nasty people on all sides, but I find in general in my life, it's just much, much worse coming from the left. I mean, incredible nastiness toward people. So their treatment of you, you're somebody they don't agree with, and you are absolutely like an unperson.
Unpersoned entirely. I said this before. I feel like Julian Assange in a way. I'm sort of quarantined away in an embassy almost, you know. I am allowed to leave, but, you know, I really have to be careful because, I mean, I walk down the street if they see me, they'll cross the street to get off the sidewalk that I'm on. It's really unbelievable.
Yeah, it is unbelievable. And one of these days when I get to New York quite a few times per year, I think you've earned a free lunch. You've earned a lunch on me.
Great. I would like to take you into one of my classes or so. I think that would be fun.
Yeah, that would be interesting. And plus, I'd like to walk through campus and see what happens.
that would be curious. You will see that I'm not exaggerating. This is probably worse than what I'm saying.
Wow.
I don't know what these people say about me behind my back. I know what they said about me on email, and it was despicable what they said. Unbelievable. I felt like writing back to that head of the diversity, equity, and inclusion group and saying, is this the kind of civility that you were referring to that I should have abided by? These people called me everything in the book. I mean, unbelievable. They, you know, I was basically called a Nazi. I was called alt-right, misogynist, Satan. I was called Satan. I was called short pants white boy. I was called fragile white male. I mean, these are all, I was being pelted with racist and sexist epithets, even as they said I was the racist and sexist.
But the idea that they would call you fragile, not one of these people has the emotional wherewithal to withstand what you've been put through. And you're the fragile one?
Right. Isn't that hilarious?
Yeah, unbelievable. Let's see. You've got, obviously, we want to get people on following you on Twitter. I'm going to link to both of those accounts because you've got, you have two accounts. So is one of them more professional than the other? One's more fun?
I saved the Dr. Rechtenwald one for my students mostly.
Okay.
And the other one is anti-PC-NYU prof, one word.
Okay, so if you're driving around, that's too much to remember. I'll link to that at tomwoods.com/1244 for the episode today.
Yeah.
And then your website, which I'm trying to, it's michaelrechtenwald.com.
That's right. Also, and then it's michaelrechtenwald.com, no dots. And then there's another website for the book itself, springtimeforsnowflakes.com.
Oh, okay. I did not have that one. All right, springtimeforsnowflakes.com.
And there you will find a lot of the media coverage, samples of my other interviews, and also other writing on social justice and PC authoritarianism.
Excellent. All right. Well, the only thing that surprises me about this situation, I'm not surprised at how you were treated or how any of it shook out, but I am surprised that you're not more of a internet celebrity, given what's happened to you. And if you'd like to become one, I know the formula. If you'd like, with a story like that, I can make you one.
Oh, I would like that. I mean, I don't understand it either, except that I haven't really been I'm more of a writer than I am a speaker. I think that my writing is just much better than what I do in, oratory. So I haven't really done the YouTube channel bit, although I'm being told I got to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, I love writing. I mean, I'm a writer. If you want to read, I think this last book is a piece of literature. I'm not boasting, but I think it's a literary work. And that's just what I like doing better. So if I haven't become an internet celebrity, it's largely because writing is my thing.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I mean, I see that. And the thing is, I love writing myself. And then I realize I make a 3-minute YouTube video and it gets, you know, tens of thousands of views almost immediately.
Yeah.
And I think, but what about that blog post I slaved over? Don't you want to read that?
Right.
But anyway, all right, we're going to, there's so many places to refer people, but all the stuff will be linked to tomwoods.com/1244. You definitely want to check out the book, Springtime for Snowflakes, Social Justice and Its Postmodern Parentage by Michael Rechtenwald of NYU. Thanks, Michael. I hope you continue on in this path that you're on, which is, we're all cheering you, around the country. I know it's hard to perceive that when you're surrounded by enemies, but you have more friends than you have enemies. They're just more scattered.
I felt that, and I really appreciate it very much.
All right, thanks again.
Thank you, Tom.
All right, folks, let's see if I succeeded in what I set out to do. I had somebody write to me and say, Woods, I've created a website, and now I'm contacting you for my shout-out. So he wrote it to me, and I looked at it, and I said, man, you are going to have to convert this into the language of the layman. So then he came back to me with what I'm about to read to you, and you tell me, because maybe you understand it better than I do. I mean, look, it's not impossible to understand, but it's still a little sciencey. But the website is called algalsyntheticbiology.com. And so he said, if you want a one-sentence answer about what the site is all about, it would be this. Genetic engineering photosynthetic microbes is really cool to some weirdos out there. And now here's his summary. He says, this is a site that would be interesting for you if you want to understand why someone would think any of the following things. Fossil fuels were generated by blooms of organic material that were trapped and sequestered from oxygen. Many molecules can only be produced by enzymatic pathways, ultimately needing a biological host. Algae and plants can capture huge amounts of solar energy, while algae are easier to engineer. And by genetically engineering algae, it may be possible to convert solar energy and simple inputs into useful bioproducts. And he goes on to say, I'm really just trying to build a website for the field I'm an expert in right now and for which I can create content and useful material. So check it out, right? You science nerds out there, can you believe the nerve of Tom Woods to call anybody else that name? The website is algalsyntheticbiology.com. That's A-L-G-A-L, syntheticbiology.com. I'll link to it at tomwoods.com/1244. You get a shout out from me and lots of other help like tutorials and membership in my private bloggers group and a link on my site if you get your hosting through my link. So how do you do all this and how do you get all the bonuses? Check it all out at tomwoods.com/publicity. And I'll see you, well, not quite next week. I got a bonus episode coming this weekend. It's that music teacher I keep telling you about who is just crushing it online. You think, a music teacher? That's amazing. These are not known as the most entrepreneurial people in the world. What is it that he's doing? We're going to talk about that this weekend. Thanks for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.